Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Syrian military tanks opened fire on protesters following Friday prayers this morning. Human rights activists say at least 2,000 people have died since the uprisings began. 8 NATO troops were killed in roadside bombs in Afghanistan, and the UK struggled to contain riots and looting across the country. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center, Yoki Driesen of the National Journal, Courtney Kuby of NBC. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you. It's been quite a week. Yoki Driesen, what's happening in Syria?
The horrors out of Hama just continue to build. I mean, we've talked on air before about the extraordinary bravery of the people of Hama, who not only know in a theoretical sense what the Assad family is willing to do to them, but many of them have lived through and seen firsthand what the Assad family is willing to do to them. I mean, it was not long ago that the elder Assad basically leveled the city and gave rise to a phrase that you hear in Hebrew in Israel, you hear it in Arabic outside of in other Arab countries in the Middle East, you hear it in English about the Hama rules or the Hama history. He killed, the low estimate is 10,000, the higher estimates are 20 or 30,000. Soon you have people going out into the streets day after day after day, up against tanks, up against snipers, up against Assad forces who show no willingness whatsoever to hold back on shooting into those crowds with live ammunition. The bravery is extraordinary. On the flip side, the death toll is continuing to just spike higher and higher.
Are there any signs of a divide in support for Assad, Nadia?
Well, what we have seen recently is the resignation or the forced resignation of the defense minister, which is Ali Habib. He's an Alawite. He's very close to the regime. There is apparently rumor that he was very unhappy about how the security forces are dealing with the demonstrators. So they put him aside and they brought somebody else called Rajaha, who's a Christian. And I think it's another message from the regime to say we're not anti-sectarian, and therefore we're bringing everybody together. This is one development. The other thing is how the Arab world is moving against Syria for the first time, led by Saudi Arabia. They have played a crucial role. The king of Saudi Arabia, who is not just the king, but also the spokesperson for the Muslim world. He is his title, official title. He is the guardian of the two holy custodians. When the king comes to speak, it means something for many factors. Number one is because he leads the Sunni world. The majority of people in Hama in particular are Sunnis. And the atrocities against him with 200 tanks into the city in the first day of Ramadan, the holiest month in the Muslim calendar, was unbearable for places like countries like Saudi Arabia. Second, in the eastern part of Syria, there are many people who have actually Saudi citizenship, and the king being seen, and they have very close alliance with the tribes. Third, I think, which is very important, we have to put it in a bigger picture, which is Iran. I think this relationship between Syria and Saudi Arabia deteriorating over a period with the assassination of Hariri, with Hezbollah, with March 14, etc. But now I think Saudi Arabia took that decision to break away completely with Damascus because they have seen it as this alliance between, it's the last alliance between Syria and Iran. The previous president managed to keep this alliance between Riyadh and Tehran on one hand. This president showed to be less nimble in dealing with regional power, and this is very important. And it opened finally the door for other countries like Kuwait, Bahrain, and others to withdraw their ambassadors and to speak publicly and say enough for this regime. He has to do something and to stop the violence and the bloodshed.
And Courtney Kuby, even Turkey stepped in.
Right. And as Nadia was saying, Saudi Arabia, the king of Saudi Arabia said this week that the killing machine must stop. That's a very strong statement to make. And there was even fresh violence this morning along the border with Lebanon, which is a sunny area, will further inflame anger in Saudi Arabia, of course. The Saudis recalled their ambassador, as did Bahrain and Kuwait. But the strongest signal this week was from Turkey. Foreign Minister Davutoğlu went to Syria this week. He met with President Assad for hours. And he took a deadline. He said, you have 2 days to end this violence or else. Turkey, of course, is the biggest trading partner with Syria. It's one of its, it's really its tie to the West, Turkey is. So for the Turkish people to come out in and say that Syria needs to stop, that's a very strong statement. And now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is saying this week that she's hoping that other nations in the region will really start to respond as well. The U.S. has imposed new sanctions against Syria. The problem is U.S. sanctions don't have too much bite. We don't have a lot of trade with Syria. So it's really going to take other European nations to impose those
sanctions. So how much bite is Turkey's comment going to have on President Assad?
Yeah, I think, frankly, despite all the rhetoric, there's not much happening. I mean, the U.S. earlier this week was ecstatic that the weakest of all possible condemnations made it through the U.S. Security, through the U.N. Security Council. And the press office of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. was touting that it was such a great milestone that Russia and China didn't veto it. But this wasn't a resolution. This was a presidential letter which carries no sanctions, no enforcement, no threat, nothing. So Saudi Arabia has hated Syria for a long time, as have the other Gulf states. I agree with Nadia that this gives them the ability to sort of pull back more fully than they had before. But right now, you're not seeing anything concrete that has bite. Mm. There's no talk of military action. There's no talk of sanctions. There's no talk of trade embargoes. So right now, if you're Assad, you feel like, yes, you have people yelling at you, but fundamentally, trade continues. The UN is not intervening. The U.S. is not talking, understandably, of intervening militarily. NATO is not talking about intervening militarily. The Saudis who sent forces into Bahrain, they're not talking about doing anything militarily. So if you're Assad, the pressure is verbal, and he's not going to respond to that.
But 2 points to add to that. Number one is we're still waiting for President Obama to come and say President Assad has to go. This is the only thing they haven't done so far. They dance around the issue, and they keep saying that Syria is better off without him. So I think they're buying some time for whatever reason. And I think it's very interesting to read into the statement the White House released yesterday, which is the call between President Obama and Prime Minister Erdogan. And if you read clearly, what they were saying is basically, it's not just we condemn what's happening, we want the violence to cease, but they're saying we will monitor the situation and reassess the situation in a few days. That means they're still giving time for Assad. And I think this is really interesting of what's happening now between Turkey and the United States. But talking about the sanction, I think the most important thing now, Hillary Clinton said yesterday, actually on a CBS interview, that she wanted the Europeans to do something, and they have to target the oil section because it counts to almost third or fourth quarter of the revenues that comes to Syria. And this is very, very important. But without hitting the population like they did with Saddam Hussein, because the important thing, they wanted the regime to fall, but you don't want the country to crumble. So you don't need to deal with the disaster afterwards. And that's the tricky issue.
The problem right now that the United States faces is the fact that there's no evidence right now that Assad's going anywhere. Right now, the middle class in Damascus and in the biggest cities in Aleppo, they are not showing any signs of turning against Assad. So unless the military forces and the middle class turns against him, he's not going anywhere at this point. So for the U.S. to go out there and take a step that no other nation has taken yet and say, we're calling for President Assad to leave, that puts them out there in a place where there's a chance that it will just make the United States look weak because we won't go anywhere. The other problem right now that they're facing is that, you know, they can call on other nations to try and help out and try and step in. For example,
China.
Exactly. But so far, there's been no response. So the U.S. doesn't want to put themselves out on a limb and call for this when there may be no response.
I think Courtney has it exactly right. I mean, not only where there may be no response, but where the U.S. itself has no ability to bring about a response. I mean, we saw with Libya, it took them a long time to get to the point of saying Gaddafi must go. That was 5 months ago. Gaddafi has not gone anywhere. And that's where the U.S. had the ability and the willingness to intervene militarily. In Syria, we have neither the interest nor the willingness nor the allies to do anything with force. So if we say Assad has to go, and then we have no way of backing it up. And he knows it, and we know it.
And, of course, considering what's happened to Mubarak in Egypt...
Yes.
And seeing him in a cage would seem to be exactly the opposite incentive for Assad to go.
Absolutely. I mean, this image in the Arab world of Mubarak in a cage on his bed being tried, it was unbelievable. So it was send this signal to Assad, this is going to be your end. And if it's not that, you're going to be led to the International Court of Justice like Milosevic and others in The Hague, and you'll be trial. So the problem with diplomacy, I think, is they never left it's a kind of a leeway of, if you wanted these people to leave, you have to give them some kind of option. And it happened with Libya, as we just mentioned now, and it's going to happen with Syria. So he knows he's fighting for his life, basically. And the Alawite who's surrounding him, especially in the army, are fighting for their life. But the middle class will only change once they realize that the wind is going to the other direction, and then we're going to see people in the streets. And I think one other thing I would like to add, which is they might withdraw tanks from Hama, but we're going to see a small killings everywhere. And I heard one of the Syrian analysts saying something very interesting. They're saying the regime is resorting to the quota of killing. That means that every day they're going to kill between 20 to 30 people just to frighten the rest not to go into mass demonstrations. We're not going to see tens of thousands of millions in the streets. So they keep the killing low, but we might not see things like Hama being sieged, cutting off the electricity, cutting off communication, arresting people en masse, killing people. Very slow intensity, but they continue with this until one side will win.
There's one other major problem that exists here, and there's no organized opposition in Syria right now. Secretary Clinton touched on that in her interview yesterday as well. Right now, there's no end game. If, in fact, President Assad were to fall today, what would happen? The reality is it would probably lead to insecurity in Israel, some sort of instability in Lebanon, and potentially a power vacuum that Iran would end up filling.
Courtney Kuby, she's national security producer for NBC News. Short break. When we come back, we'll talk about Afghanistan. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Yoki Driesen of National Journal Magazine, Courtney Kuby, National Security Producer for NBC News, and Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center. Let's turn now to Afghanistan. NATO says it has killed those responsible for the helicopter crash that took the lives of some 22 SEALs plus 8 others. What do you make of this, Yoki?
Well, in some ways, this came out of a briefing that General John Allen, the new commander in Afghanistan, gave, where he in many ways buried the lead, as we say in journalism, where it wasn't until the very end of the briefing that he admitted that the target of the raid, the reason the Rangers were sent in first and the SEALs sent in second, had escaped. So the person they were actually after, the person that all of these special operations forces were put at risk to get, we have not gotten. He has not been killed. He has not been captured. And it's an interesting example of the way the military public relations machine works, because that spin worked. The stories that ran, particularly because the wire services have to write so quickly, were U.S. killed guy who shot down helicopter, not U.S. target escapes, which is actually a more important takeaway. But even if you ignore for a second the fact that the target got away, there is no way of knowing. And afterwards, he was asked during the press conference and refused to go into it. The other military press people in the room wouldn't go into it. Their explanation was it's operational detail, so we can't tell you. If you read between the lines of the military press releases, what they imply happened is that they had drones overhead, so they were able to track the people as they were leaving, that they were listening into cell phone calls, and they were able to piece together based on cell phone traffic and other things they observed through the drones who the shooter was. How you could possibly know with absolute certainty which of the 20 men with beards and guns and civilian clothing who were all shooting happened to be the one who fired the RPG as opposed to the AK-47 when there was more than one RPG fired. I'm skeptical of it understates considerably.
There are new questions being raised about the mission that actually resulted in that helicopter going down, Yoki.
Part of it is fueled by the military itself. I mean, in the initial aftermath, what was being said by the military, both in its formal statements but also in a lot of the background stuff in it that we were all hearing from people in Afghanistan, was this was a rescue mission, effectively, that you had Rangers who were looking for this target, this man who escaped. They were pinned down and in need of assistance. The SEALs were sent in to assist these Rangers who were at risk of being overrun, killed, captured. General Allen gave an entirely different explanation. His explanation was the Rangers were searching for this man who got away. While they were there, they saw other people running away from the scene, and the SEALs were sent in to try to prevent those people from escaping, which is a very different kind of mission. And frankly, that's the kind of mission that you don't need SEALs to do. That's the kind of mission that conventional forces trained to do, can do often. So you have the military's explanation for the mission itself changing, the target escaping. And every person I've talked to from within that community is sort of, on the one hand, just heartbroken beyond words that SEAL Team 6, which has 300 members roughly, now lost a huge swath of its membership to this one crash. But they're also flummoxed that you would send in members of SEAL Team 6. Again, these are the guys who shot the Somali. Why so many and why these? I mean, SEAL Team 6 were the guys who shot the Somali pirates, one of the most difficult shots military snipers have ever seen. These are the guys who went after bin Laden. These are the best of the best of the best. They should not have been sent to do what conventional forces can do.
So why were they?
That remains a mystery. General Allen yesterday said that they were part of the planning for this mission, they were part of the planning. But that, again, conflicts with earlier accounts, which were that they were on the base nearby, able to go quickly, but not part of the original planning. So the military itself can't get its story straight, and the story that emerges is one where you look at it and listen to it and think, this was a mistake from the start.
You know, we talked in the last hour about the loss of public faith in government, and that certainly includes the hierarchy of the military, when you cannot get straight answers, Nadia.
Absolutely, and I think this is, General Allen said as well, I think there is an investigation. We might know the details later on, but not now, because initially it might be a cover-up. I'm not just saying that, but we will know later. But I think the fact that they don't want to admit mistakes sometimes, as you said, I mean, 10% of the Navy SEALs wiped out in one attack, it just doesn't make logic to anybody. I mean, we know, for example, that the president and the vice president or the crown prince and the king cannot travel in the same plane for this sake of it might be a crash, and therefore you lose top echelon of power in any country. So let alone the military, when they fight in a war like in Afghanistan, what on earth has gone into their thinking to put all these people in one plane? But General Allen said as well, this is part of ongoing efforts to fight the enemy wherever they are, and then we went to Wardak to this orchard to track them down, and immediately the Taliban, to add insult to injury, the Taliban spokesman came out and they said, no, this Mujahid, as they call him, one of the Taliban, is not one of the people who shot the plane. How on earth would they know that? So I think I agree with what Jasyuki said. It is laughable.
I think I had a slightly different experience with the reporting on this story. I was told Sunday morning that this was not a rescue mission. I was told Sunday morning, in fact, I specifically was speaking to someone and I said, yeah, we heard that they went in to rescue these Rangers. And the person said, no, that's not right. They were support. They were a reinforcement. They were an what the military calls an IRF, an immediate reaction force. So they were, as Yoki said, they were planned to go in and to be the support on the backup on these Rangers. And one of the
why so many SEALs?
That's one question. The SEALs were part of the training. The one question that no one can answer so far is why so many. It was actually 17. 15 were members of the SEAL Team 6, 2 were a West Coast, and the others were assigned to the SEAL unit, but they were actually support. There was a dog handler, an EOD guy, some IT specialists. So That's one question that is going to have to be answered here, is why they sent in 17 SEALs on this mission. There were Afghans involved as well. It's a nighttime raid. They're very standard in that area. They're standard. Frankly, it's standard to send in a big immediate reaction force. Just the question is why many were special forces of this caliber. I think another question that really needs to be answered out of this raid is, was not just dedicating the SEALs, also dedicating those Rangers and those troops on the ground for someone who, in the end, it's seeming more and more was a mid-level local Taliban guy in Wardak. So far, all the accounts are that he was not some high-level Haqqani network figure, because they exist in that area, in that part of Wardak. He was just a local Taliban leader who had about 12 guys, maybe some suicide bombers who worked for him, but that was it. So tremendous loss.
This is, again, questions about the intelligence we're getting.
I think it's in some ways less a question about the intelligence and more a question about military resourcing and military planning. And there is a big strategic question here. And the big strategic question is, if you talk to people in that community and they talk about this publicly, they will say this raid was nothing unusual, that there are 10, 12, 15 of these run per night involving various configurations of special operations troops. And they have very impressive statistics that the number of raids last year in Afghanistan alone was 4,000. They've killed 600 Taliban or Haqqani leaders, 2,000 fighters. But by every measure, every single measure that exists, the number of attacks in Afghanistan is higher than ever before. In June, the number of IEDs set an all-time record for the war at 1,600. The casualty rate for this year is on pace to break last year, which in turn had broken 2009, which in turn had broken 2008. So you have the military openly admit that this part of sort of targeted counterterror missions, forgetting for a second who the targets are, but just that this tactic of sending in guys by helicopter at night to kill or capture wanted militants is a key part of the strategy. But then that raises the bigger question of, but the strategy by every measure is not working.
I think there's one other thing that's also going to come out of this investigation. A couple weeks ago, it wasn't well reported on. There was this raid that started out in a kind of a similar way. They went in after some local Taliban guys. They got to their compound. It was a 48-hour firefight where the military kept sending in more and more special forces. I can't say for certain, but I think that one thing that may come out of this investigation is perhaps that because of what they learned out of that, a Delta Force guy was killed in that raid. Maybe they overreacted to this, and they didn't want to have another long, protracted firefight spent hours and hours, and they just wanted to go in, send the SEALs in, you know, knock it out, and get them out of there. And unfortunately, it backfired in this case.
So we have the killing continuing there. And in Libya, what about the rebels there? Has any progress been made, Nadia?
Well, militarily, I think we have seen the taking of this strategic town of Deir el-Ghanam. I think it made some kind of a turnover, probably in an otherwise very stale military battle between Gaddafi forces and the rebels. That might change something. But I think that the bigger picture here is what happened within the TNC. And we have seen in the last few days that they have took a decision to dissolve the what they call the cabinet, which is basically 14 member executive member of this committee led by Jalil, and it came in the light of the killing of General Abdel Fattah Yunus. Now, some saying that don't expect a huge change. It's going to be just a little bit of arrangement here and there that Jalil will keep people close to him, like Mahmoud Shammam and others. But some will say basically that it's a good time for them to regroup and to reorganize and to have better thinking, including the State Department, that they commented on that and they said, yes, this is a good thing to see them having a clearer thinking and a strategy. And maybe they formed a coherent strategy to fight Gaddafi. But also that shows there is so much things that we don't know about what happened to Abdel Fattah Yunus, who killed him in the end, was it an internal or not, was he a double agent? It's just so many rumors, Diane, that we cannot really know for a fact what happened inside the cabinet itself, except that, you know, all the Western countries has already recognized
them.
And they invited them to open offices elsewhere. And we see this division and the killing, and not just the killing, but asking the general to come to a place interrogating him killing him in the most horrendous way and burning his body and throw him on the side of the road. And then they find out what happened to him. So it all raises question about this DNC.
And, of course, this week we also saw Gaddafi's son on television.
That's right.
What does that tell us?
Well, you know, no one... The situation in Libya just seems to get more and more confusing every single day. You know, there was reports of an air raid this week that may have killed dozens of Libyan local civilians. The NATO says that it was a legitimate target, but the Libyans are saying that it was not. At this point, it's so confusing over where the leadership is. That right now, you know, as Nadia was saying, when the general was killed, they had to dissolve the executive committee to reduce these tensions. The problem is, Who's the leadership of the rebels now? You know, they already had a fractured rebel leadership. They have these areas in the east, the mountainous areas in the west, that really don't feel any loyalty to this TNC, this rebel leadership. So what's going to happen if, in fact, Gaddafi were to fall? You know, it's like Syria. If he were to fall today, what comes next?
Yeah, okay.
What's interesting is that the TNC is trying hard to learn all the mistakes the U.S. made in Iraq and not make them, which I find fascinating. So they have plans, open plans, that if Gaddafi were to fall, they would rehire his police and his military funded by the West so that there's no chaos. They have plans for a government, for a constitution writing committee, sort of a very detailed roadmap in a way that we, frankly, as a country, did not have when we invaded Iraq, which is on one hand wonderful. On the other, right now all it is a plan. It's not clear who'd implement it. It's not clear who the power players would be. So how you get from planning stage to reality, that's the complication.
Yoki Drizna of National Journal Magazine. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Well, we've had a week of riots in the UK. What do you expect the political fallout to be?
Well, the Prime Minister came back from his holiday. He was in Tuscany. He thought that maybe it's going to be over in 2 days. And as we have seen, even tonight, it's still tense in the streets of London and other cities. He called all the MPs in an emergency session, both the opposition Ed Miliband as well as the Prime Minister. They were talking together about how we have to end this culture of violence, that we're not going to have the culture of fear in the streets. So already Cameron is taking so much heat, and many of his cabinets, for the statement that they said that the police were dealing with it as a law and order issue. But actually now what we have seen is street gangs, the crimes all over, especially in Tottenham, which has witnessed a riot in 1985. Another controversial issue that came this morning, which is about hiring an American to head the Scotland Yard because he has an experience with riots in the United States. So they were talking about Bill Bratton, that he could be leading. And of course, there is opposition to that.
Where had he been?
Sorry?
Where had his fellow been?
Los Angeles.
He was before. And they wanted to bring him because he has an experience of how you deal with inner cities,
sure,
etc. And Cameron was talking about even using water cannon, plastic bullets, all kind of measure to end it. And it's fascinating to see it in so many ways because, yes, Britain is a class-oriented society. You have the haves and the have-nots. And there is disparity between the rich and the poor. But I think this one in particular was taken by the street gangs and vandalism and this culture of people that it's very fascinating because I talked to a few Brits the other night and they were saying that this young generation feel they're entitled, Diane, to so many things like piracy in music. Everything is free. They can take it from the internet. And therefore, when they wanted something, they don't have to work hard for it. They can go and vandalize. And it's horrible. We have seen houses being burned to the ground. Businesses, we're not talking about multi-million companies. We're not talking about big business. We're talking about a small business, a barber shop and a businessman here. It's burned to the ground.
Yeah, I think Nadia's right. There is a tremendous socioeconomic divide that exists right now in London, and it's fueled by these austerity cuts, economic cuts right now. One in five youth in London is unemployed or underemployed at this point. So, you know, this all started last Saturday when this man named Mark Duggan was shot by the police. It's still under investigation. The people came to protest his killing, and it all sort of grew. It started as they were protesting his killing. Then it became about police brutality. Then it became about the larger, you know, anti-government message and the socioeconomic class and racism. And the sad part is these protests grew out of this small localized issue, and it a herd mentality took over.
But I think we have to make note of the fact that youth unemployment in this country is at 20%. In the UK, it's at 40%, Yogi.
I mean, I think it's very easy because so often, as we are now, we're talking about specific events that historical moments happen and you don't realize they've happened until you look back. But I think we can safely say that we are now in a historical moment, not just because of the riots, not just because of the economic collapse here and the near self-inflicted headshot wound we did over the debt default and whether to raise the debt ceiling. But there's a sense that you could see signs of across the globe that the system that was in place for the last nearly 60 years, the kind of post-World War II economic, cultural, educational, that's all fracturing. It's not just the riots in England. It's not just the riots in Greece, where if you remember, there was a pregnant bake teller who burned to death when anarchists threw firebombs into a bank in protest, the first of many protests in Greece against austerity measures. But there's just a feeling of something fundamental has broken.
Yoki Drees-Nab, National Journal. When we come back, we'll talk about the economy in Europe, what that false rumor was about France, and take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic, at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
The new documentary, Magic Trip, features previously unreleased footage shot during the Mary Prankster's psychedelic bus trip across America in 1964. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Ken Kesey, one of the organizers of the trip, writer Robert Stone, who met up with the Pranksters in New York, and Tom Wolfe, who documented the trip in his book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Join us.
And here's our first email from Nina in Hickory, North Carolina, who says, why is it that on Wednesday, August 10, I read in The Guardian that, quote, debt crisis, share prices slump in response to France deficit, rumors that France could be stripped of AAA credit rating, prompts drop of around 400 points on Wall Street. And the next day, I read in the same Guardian that, quote, European stock markets rally as fears of France downgrade abate. Why do I not hear anything about France in any discussion of Wall Street's wild swing in our media? What was going on with Wall Street and France, Nadia?
Well, I think it's basically everything happens after the S&P in the United States. And once it happened to the United States, everybody started looking elsewhere, including the Eurozone, which has already been in debt crisis for month, and we talked about this before. And they looked at France, and they said, well, if we can downgrade the United States, look at France. And they have an equivalent society, Sacre Bleu, which is equivalent to S&P there. And they basically looked at the French economy, and they said the central, one of the major major banks there, maybe it's not good on its credit. So therefore, the rumor came that maybe the French won't be fulfilling their obligations, and therefore the rumor came specifically targeting France because of the bank system there, and because France is also linked to the Eurozone, unlike Britain. You know, both of these countries are supposed to do the cuts, but because Britain has been secured somehow because of their sterlings, while France is connected to the rest of Europe. And they did also a big bailout of other weaker economy that we talked about, which is Greece and Portugal.
All right.
But it seems they're doing okay today, but we cannot predict the market. We're going to make much more money if we did. But
the market's up right now 141 points. In Europe, it's up 157. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Rachel.
Oh, dude, sweet. sorry about that. Sorry, my sister's calling. Hold on.
Rachel,
comment? I actually get nervous sometimes. But yeah, my call actually has to do with the riots in London. It just brings me back to once upon a time, long a decade ago, and here in Cincinnati, Ohio, our city made national news after one Timothy Thomas got shot by cops and sparked massive riots, especially in over the Rhine and East Walnut Hills and areas in that part of town. And we had, you know, the whole police brutality, race relations, and that was the main topic of discussion up until the towers got hit, unfortunately.
Okay, so Rachel, your point is you're comparing what happened back then to what's happening in the UK?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Courtney.
Well, you know, she's right. The police right now in the UK are also in a tough state. They're just coming off of this phone hacking scandal where they lost their leadership. Their credibility is low. They're also facing austerity measures. They're probably going to lose some police officers. Now that seems to be maybe in jeopardy whether they're going to cut any police officers. There was one thing that came out of these London riots that Prime Minister Cameron spoke about yesterday that I was surprised didn't get more attention, and that was that one of the things he considered doing was curbing social media, people getting together via social media. And I thought, I gasped when I heard that, because this is after the Arab Spring, where so many Western nations, they encouraged people to get together via social media in Tunisia and Egypt and all these other nations. And then he comes out, and because it's working against him, he actually said that sometimes the free flow of information can work against you. And I literally, it was like nails on chalkboard to me to hear him say that. I was amazed that didn't get more attention.
Yeah, but what's interesting, I wanted to add, it wasn't Twitter and Facebook, just like they were the enablers in the Arab Spring, but it was the BlackBerry. And because these youth, apparently with using BBM, which is BlackBerry Messengers, which many of us don't know. Actually, my son introduced me to it. And apparently, BlackBerry is the most popular smartphone among British teenagers because it is private, it's cheap, and it's very quick. You can spread messages. Nobody can see them to the group that they want. And apparently, the street gangs were sending messages where to loot, where to convene, where to gather. And this is what he was talking about. But I agree with you entirely. In a country that revered democracy and freedom of expression, that the prime minister talking about cutting off this ways of communication between people. It's just interesting.
It's worth remembering that Britain is functionally in many ways a police state. Britain has more closed cameras, video cameras than any other country on the planet. Britain has laws banning people from assembling at night. They have what are called basically you can go to court if you have a neighbor who's too loud, get an injunction against your neighbor to make them quieter. Britain has more laws restricting free speech, free assembly. It has the harshest libel laws on the planet in terms of journalism, where the burden of proof is on the journalist accused of libel, not on the person making the case. So, yes, on the one hand, this is a country that helped develop democracy. On the other, this is a country that's no stranger to these kind of measures.
To Sugarland, Texas. Good morning, Eric.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying your show. I think the simple backdrop to my comments regarding the riots and who's doing it and why in the U.K., is based on my having lived in the UK for 20 years as a teacher in North London, northwest London. I'm very familiar with British society. I became a British citizen. I retained my U.S. citizenship. And operating in education, education's gone radically downhill in both American, of course, and British society, radically. Primary and secondary education, elementary, middle schools, and high school level. And aside from that, the people rising, I suspect, and from my communicating with my friends there a lot, are people, kids, whose parents, single family household or not, are on state support, on adult.
Quite a statement.
Well, yeah, Eric is right. There was just a heartbreaking image this week of a father whose son was killed in the rioting, and he came out and tearfully said, "Please, if you love your kids, keep them home. Don't let them out on the streets." So Eric makes a good point. And you know, as we said earlier, it's 1 in 5 youth in London are unemployed right now. So there's this, you have this tremendous population that, as we mentioned earlier, are connecting via social media. They feel disenchanted, they are disenfranchised, and they're angry. And once they all get together, this herd mentality takes over, and unfortunately, they rage and they loot for the sake of raging and looting.
All right, to Hampton Roads, Virginia. Good morning, Benjamin.
Hey, good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say I took a little exception to the coverage of the Navy SEALs that were killed tragically this past week. You know, in situations like this, in first response situations, which is similar to what this is, details are hard to come by. It's hectic. The commanders on the ground are active in rescue situations, rescue operations, and just the actual combat. So I took a little exception at the implication that it was either incompetent or deliberate, that it was hard to get the correct story. It's a long ways away, and, you know, it's difficult to get facts, not necessarily incompetence or, like I said, deliberate. And also, you know, as citizens, we do have a responsibility to question our leaders' policymaking, but I think that we need to be careful about correcting tactics. There was the question, you said, Diane, a couple times, why did they use so many SEALs? And that's a tactical decision made by on-scene commanders. And as somebody who hasn't been in combat, it's difficult for us to go and Monday morning quarterback those decisions that, like I said, are tactical versus broader policy decisions that we should be questioning.
Benjamin, I appreciate your call. Yoki.
There's a lot in there that I think we would all agree with. I mean, certainly it's difficult when you're thousands of miles away. You're not in as he's pointing out. I mean, some of us who have been embedded, we've been in situations watching this unfold, and
right.
Information is hitting these guys in real time. No question, these decisions are hard to make and shouldn't be just second guessed for the sake of second guessing. But there are two things I would take issue with in what he said. First, and even in his comment, was implicit that this was a rescue mission, and that the reason of sending in all these SEALs and the reason why we shouldn't second-guess it was there were lives at stake, it was a rescue mission, et cetera. The military itself says that is not the case. So the military, the on-scene commander would know if it was a rescue mission or if it was not a rescue mission, and the military says it was not. The other thing is that it is a fair question, and it is a legitimate question to question the tactics of war, particularly since in the case of many of the three of us, particularly Courtney and I, who are at the Pentagon a lot, this is not being questioned just by people outside the military. This past week, I interviewed three special operations people in Afghanistan, one person who had been a former commander of SEAL Team 6. All of them, to a person, questioned why so many SEALs, why were they being used for this, did this target justify that expenditure? So it's not Monday morning quarterback by idiot journalists. It's people from that very elite community have these same questions.
And from Raphael in Dallas, who says, how many more lives do we have to lose before we decide to pull out of Afghanistan and Iraq? Why not learn from Vietnam? It's a question lots of people are posing, Courtney.
It's a question a lot of people are asking, and I don't know anyone who ever have heard has a good answer to it, unfortunately. You know, the military is saying that if they get through these next fighting season and a half, which is sort of their way of saying the most difficult time of the year in Afghanistan, they'll be able to make enough progress. The Afghans will take over the fight, and that in the end they're going to cut down on the number of Americans who are there, the lives that are being lost, the casualties. I mean, candidly, you know, I was just there last week. We were in these areas, Tarin Kaut, where they've turned over security to the Afghans. You know, I didn't see it. I didn't see evidence that the Afghans are capable of controlling the security in their areas. At this point, it continues to be a war of whack-a-mole. As the NATO forces come through, they clear out areas, and the insurgents, the bad guys, they just move around to different parts. And it's literally like an oil spill that as they continue to squeeze it, the oil just spreads throughout the country. And so I wish I had an answer for his question. It's a good one that we all should be asking ourselves.
All right, to Northport, Florida. Good morning, Jeff.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Diane, I really think that we're overanalyzing the situation that's going on in London, and also what we're having going on in Newark and Philadelphia with these kids with the flash mobs that are going in and, you know, and robbing these stores, basically overwhelming the stores. I think it really boils down to what Danny said, which is just a breakdown in the culture of our youth, and I don't need to get into the schematics of it. I think it really boils down to, a lack of work ethic. I mean, sure, we could talk about a lack of opportunities, but I'm 28, Diane, and I can tell you right now, he's down here in Southwest Florida and in my experiences around our country, our youth does not have a work ethic. They're not concerned about employment. I mean, I'm not labeling all of them in that group, but if you listen to, you know, rap, if you're into popular culture here that our youth are into, the message, you know, from a lot of the rap artists, you know, that are talking to these inner city kids especially, is that having a job is for sats, that it's a joke, that, you know, that, and these kids want the stuff that they're seeing on these rappers. They want the sneakers. They want the bracelets. So when they see an opportunity, when that glass is broken on that store, no one's put no one has instilled in them the values to know that it's not acceptable to go into that store and take these things.
All right, Jeff, thanks for calling. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nadia.
Yes, I mean, this is generally what I said, basically. It is this culture of entitlement. But that's not, it's only one factor. I think it's so many things that's been happening. The budget cut, I mean, the cut down in the police force, the austerity measures that's been taken, this gap between the inner cities. And you see it very much. And I also lived in London for a while. And you can see it clearly, this difference between the glamorous royal family that everybody look up to. And then you go to the inner city, which is half an hour drive from Pakistan. Palace, and you'll be shocked as if you're going to a third world country. So these things are there. But I agree with the caller as well. There is this culture of the young people, as I said, that if you don't have it, then you can have it somewhere else. And actually, it was a very interesting interview on NPR by the MP from Tottenham himself. And he said, I'm a black person. I grow up on this, that if you want something, you work for it. But these youth, regardless of where they come from, you know, different ethnic background, they believe that if they can break into a shop and they can take that iPod or that TV or whatever, then it's okay because the state is against you and therefore is justified.
All
and
right.
I think it's very wrong.
To Foley, Alabama. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. I have to call in. The caller said to learn from the lessons of Vietnam. How many more people do we have to lose in Afghanistan before we pull out? Well, one of the lessons in Vietnam was that we left the job unfinished, as we did when I was in Lebanon under Reagan. We left the job unfinished. And then with Black Hawk Down, Clinton left the job unfinished in Somalia. And then we ended up with bin Laden, who saw the Mujahideen defeat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and then saw us run away in those three conflicts and says, I can take on the United States of America because we're the stronger horse and America is the weaker horse.
I mean, I agree with this, with the second half of that, in the sense that that is the internal kind of jihadi view of history. I mean, their narrative is we've beaten the West, and they count Russia and the West and the purpose of Afghanistan repeatedly. But there's a sort of dangerous logic, I think, to that if you take it and you could just continue it endlessly, which is to say then the war will never end because Afghanistan will never become what we would consider a stable society, a wealthy society, a literate society. So if our argument is we have to stay or else the jihadists who are fundamentally irrational in some ways and rational in others, until we've convinced them that we're there to stay, we never leave, and we cannot afford it.
And final question, we do have new aid going to Somalia. Is it going to get there, Courtney?
Well, that's one of the questions that we're hoping it will get there. The U.S. has now committed more than $100 million in aid to Somalia. It's just devastating, heartbreaking images coming out of Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, where there's tens of thousands of people have streamed in from the drought in Somalia, women and children, and they're malnourished. And the saddest part is all they need is a tiny little bit of aid, of help, and they can survive. But there's al-Shabaab and the tensions in Somalia. They're keeping this aid from getting to the people, and the situation continues to be just devastating.
Courtney Kuby of NBC News, Yoki Driesen of National Journal, Nadia Bilbasi, Middle East Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.